This is Fresh Air. I'm TV critic David Bean Cooley. Almost every time TV takes a look at itself and tries to explore or explain what it does as a medium, the result is a major disappointment, at least to me. I want TV to take itself seriously, but it almost never does. Every show about TV is either one of those dumb top 100 lists that networks like E! And VH1 crank out every month, or it's a show that's built entirely around the guests it can book, the clips it can afford, and the shows on its own network it wants to promote. I'm happy to say, actually I'm thrilled to say, that we're about to be treated to a glorious exception. A new four-part documentary series called America in Primetime premieres this Sunday on PBS. And it's the smartest TV show about television I've seen in about 20 years. Each one-hour installment looks at a different type of TV character. Independent women, the man of the house, the misfit, and the crusader. And examines them very thoughtfully and very entertainingly. One of the things America in Primetime does that's so smart and so refreshing is that it gathers together many of the stars and writer-producers who have made the very best television, from classic shows to ones still in production today, and has them talk not only about their shows, but ones created by others. Another neat trick, and I've never seen this done before, is that it doesn't divide between comedy and drama. So in a segment on The Man of the House, you get Norman Lear, the creator of All in the Family, talking about that show's characters, and Rob Reiner, who starred as Archie Bunker's son-in-law Meathead, talking about a moment of improvisation with co-star Carol O'Connor. But you also get Tom Fontana, the producer of such dark dramas as Homicide, Life on the Street, and Oz, raving about the results of that improv, as an appreciative viewer and as a gifted TV writer himself. The first voice you hear is that of Norman Lear.
The fact that the show had been successful freed us to let these people be themselves. You know, so we were able to write them from the inside out, not from the outside in.
Wait, hold it. Hold it. What are you doing here? What? What about the other foot? There ain't no sock on it. I'll get to it.
He stopped me in the middle of rehearsal and said, "What are you doing?" I said, "What do you mean, what am I doing?
Don't you know that the whole world puts on a sock and a sock and a shoe and a shoe?"
We got into this improvised discussion about it.
I like to take care of one foot at a time.
The directors and writers were writing it down and taking it.
That's the dumbest thing I ever heard in my life.
I mean, that had nothing to do with anything that was going on in the time. That's just human behavior. It still holds up because that's just rich character stuff.
In this documentary, directed by Lloyd Kramer and executive produced by Kramer, Tom Yellen, and others, there's no narration and no writing as such. Just people interviewed about their craft, making observations about TV, and lots of clips from television to make and probe each point. That's why PBS is the perfect home for this kind of program. Public television gets special dispensation to show these clips without having to pay the normal rights fees. So we see a lot of television here. And, for once, the right clips. We see the connection between Larry David's writing on Seinfeld and his performing on Curb Your Enthusiasm. We see how Mary Tyler Moore led to Murphy Brown and how they, in turn, led to Nurse Jackie. And when these people talk about TV, they don't feel the need to play nice and agree. While most writer-producers in this show talk about television drama series as a novel, allowing an examination of characters over dozens of hours instead of just a movie-length drama, Sopranos creator David Chase asks, what's so great about that? Who needs a Casablanca 2, 3, or 4? And when it comes to the idea of having a serial killer as your central character in Showtime's Dexter, you'd be surprised who doesn't approve of that concept. At least I was surprised. Because right along with Michael C. Hall, the star of Dexter, talking about his vengeful character, you have Tom Fontana and then David Simon, creator of The Wire, talking about why they think Dexter goes too far. In this clip, you'll hear Fontana first, then Michael C. Hall, then Fontana again, and finally, David Simon.
You know, it's a very, very intriguing television series, but it is one of those shows you go like, eesh.
I know early on in the show, people who were watching it would approach me and say that they kind of felt guilty about the fact that they liked the show.
God knows I've written a lot of serial killers in my time, but I've never asked the audience to believe in the triumph of a serial killer.
There's nothing wrong with depicting violence. Violence is part of the human condition. I understand that their tongue is in their cheek in a way, and I understand it's sort of an inside-out show. But frankly, as well a show as it may be made, I don't want to be part of any show that would suggest that there's a catharsis in violence, in serial killing.
I love the debate that ensues from that, just as much as I love Dexter and The Wire and Homicide. I love America in Primetime, too. When you watch it, you're likely to be excited by the examples they choose. The hour on Misfits covers everything from The Addams Family and Freaks and Geeks to Taxi and True Blood. And every example they show is a TV program you should seek out and enjoy. And the same goes for America in Primetime. You can join us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at NPR Fresh Air. And you can download podcasts of our show at freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham, with additional engineering support from Joyce Lieberman and Julian Hirschfeld. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Melody Kramer is our associate producer of online media. Roberta Sharrock directs the show. For Terry Gross, I'm David Bean Cooley.
If you are a fan of rap, if you follow new artists, then you've probably heard of Krayshawn.
Gucci, Gucci, Louis, Louis, Fendi, Fendi, Prada. I'm looking like Madonna, but I'm flossing like Ivana Trump.
Her song Gucci, Gucci was a monster hit online.
Young, rich, and flashy. I be where the cash be. You can't find that. I think you need a Google map.
Krayshawn was nominated for a Best New Artist Award at this year's MTV Video Music Awards, or VMAs. She didn't win, but it was a sign of her growing following. But at the same time, her music and her persona have sparked outsized buzz among hip-hop fans and critics. Krayshawn often performs with two other rappers in a group that she calls the White Girl Mob, and some criticize her style as a stereotype and her lyrical content as offensive. And just to let you know, we will be hearing some of those controversial lyrics in a moment, because Krayshawn joins us now. Welcome to the program. Thanks for joining us.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Well, I understand that you just signed a big deal with Columbia Records, so congratulations are in order.
Yeah, thank you. You know, it's exciting.
Yeah. Tell me what that's like. You've been out here working and doing your thing, and then a deal like this comes along. Tell me what's on your mind right now.
Well, you know, right now it's just like, you know, taking in a new job, basically, and just learning how to, you know, do press and learning how to do shows and just learning how to travel and be like an everywhere type of woman. So, you know, it's exciting, especially learning the business side of stuff, you know.
Well, no, it's exciting for us to kind of, we feel like we're catching you just kind of on the cusp of a new chapter. Tell us a little bit about how you did grow up. You grew up in Oakland, as I understand. Tell us a little bit more, if you would.
I grew up in the Bay Area. I was born in San Francisco. I was raised in Oakland, so I'm like super Bay Area born. And, you know, it's just really multicultural up there, and there's a lot of subcultures just from like anything, like from rockabilly to like crazy punk scenes to, you know, a huge rap scene. And there's just all kinds of things you can do out there. So I was just raised to really embrace myself and just be, you know, whatever I want to be and do anything I wanted to do. So
tell me about the White Girl Mob. It's not just girl mob. It's not, you know, friend mob. It's White Girl Mob. Tell me a little bit about it. Why is that important to put the white in there? Well, you are white. I'm not saying you shouldn't be white, but is it important for you to kind of represent being white in rap?
Well, the White Girl Mob was just me and my two sisters. And, you know, we made this up before the rap and everything started popping off. sometimes, like, I realize that, you know, that is kind of like a crazy name, you know what I'm saying? But then at the same time, there's been successful groups like the NWA who've had, like, you know, which is, it's not the same as the White Girl Mob, but it has, like, the same type of group name, you know what I'm saying? So.
Well, not only do you talk about, you know, race in a funny way, you know, in a funny way, but you also talk about something that Americans don't often like to talk about, which is class and this whole question of what it means to have money or not to have money, and which is something, of course, that Gucci also alludes to. But I just want to play a little bit of a clip from, and I just have to give a language advisory here. This is not a word that everybody wants to hear, but it's parents be advised. It's this clip is from Rich Horse. Here it is.
Rich Horse, standing at the thrift store. Line it up, sniff horse.
What was the inspiration for this?
That song was kind of just like, you know, it's just like a jam song for, like, people to have fun to. And, you know, there's definitely a culture of women, like, from upper-class families who, you know, end up going to art school or going to school in New York or San Francisco or L.A., and, you know, I'm not saying, like, they all, you know, party, but I'd have to say, you know, a good percentage of them party. And that song is just kind of a song for everyone to just get wild to, for sure.
If you're just joining us, this is Tell Me More from NPR News. We're visiting with rapper Krayshawn. We're talking about her music, her style, and some of the reasons why she pushes people's buttons. Well, one of the things that I wanted to talk to you about is that your music, your style, and I've also listened to a lot of your interviews, a lot of what you're saying is that it's important just to be yourself, be whoever you want to be. It's interesting that there have been these long, impassioned pieces on the music blogs, you know, asking, you know, are you for real or are you pretending to be black in order to build cred, this kind of thing. I'm curious about a number of things. First of all, what do you make of it, especially since you're only just at the beginning of your career? So I'm curious, like, why you think you push all these people's buttons? And then to the substance of it. Talk a little bit about that, if you would.
Well, you know, you got to remember, you know, I'm a product of my environment. Like, I grew up in Oakland, and I've seen every race all get along and all live on the same street and be in the same community. So, like, you know, for people to say, like, someone is supposed to act a certain way because of their race or they're not supposed to act this way because of their race, like, I think that's racist. Like, you can't tell a certain race, like, you're supposed to act this way and you're not supposed to act this way because of what color you are. Like, that's just holding everybody back. You know what I'm saying? And if I grew up, you know, in the ghetto, like, and I wasn't taught any other way to talk or a way to act or other food to eat or just like anything like that, like, what am I supposed to do, you know? Like, is there a class I'm supposed to take to learn how to be white, you know? Or, you know, if a black person grew up in a rich community, and is there a class that they're supposed to take, you know what I'm saying? So it's just like, you know, I'm just being me, and that's why I don't even read, like, all that stuff, because all they say is just like a whole bunch of made up stuff most of the time.
Where do you get the inspiration from for your songs?
I get a lot of inspiration, you know, lately, you know, from traveling and just, you know, I got the inspiration from Gucci from, you know, growing up in Oakland and then coming down to LA and just seeing the difference between, like, the LA culture and the Bay Area culture. Like, in LA, like, there's a lot of, like, materialism and, you know, people who think they're better than each other because of the clothes they wear or how they dress. And in Oakland, it's not like that, you know? Like, everybody who's broke all lives in the same community. Like, we're all from the same area, and we all know each other. So in L.A., it's just, like, everything is separated by, like, class and materialism and stuff like that. So, you know, that's...
If you come out to D.C. and I see you rocking a Gucci bag, I'm going to call you out, right?
Yeah, you have the acceptance to slap me if you want to.
Well, I won't be slapping you, but I will be calling you out. Okay, now you know I have to ask you about the language piece, because I understand that you said in an interview that you don't use the N-word. You know, it's just the perpetual thing about rap and hip-hop is, you know, the language. You don't use the N-word, right, to describe black people. That's correct. But you do use the B-word.
Yeah.
A lot, freely.
The female dog word.
The female dog word. What's up with that?
Yeah.
What's up with that? A lot of people view them as equivalent, at least in terms of disrespect. So tell me about that.
Well, it's crazy because, you know, a lot of interviews I get, people have called me a feminist rapper. Like, people have called me a feminist rapper, and I would say, you know, I'm making music more geared towards women, but at the same time, you know, you get a lot of guys that'll call you the B word and stuff like that. But when you're within a group of your girlfriends, it's different. Like, all your girlfriends call each other that to get your attention or, you know, like in a joking way. So, you know, it's all just in a joking way to connect with female fans because, I mean, if you called a guy that, he would probably be pretty mad at you. You know what I'm saying? But if you call a girl that and you know this girl, like, it's not in a disrespectful way.
Okay, well, I won't be calling you that. And hopefully you won't be calling me that, just so we're clear, okay? All right. Okay. All right. Well, before we let you go, and it's been a pleasure to speak with you, and as I said, congratulations on everything you're doing. And when you become Madonna huge, you're going to come back and talk to us again, right? And you're not going to act like we don't know you. Okay, for sure. What's next for you? What are you working on now? I know you're working. You've been signed to your record label, so presumably you've got something coming out. What's next for you?
Well, I'm going on, like, my first, like, 2-week tour where I'm going to be, like, on a bus and everything, and it's going to be pretty exciting, so that's going to be taking up, you know, some time, and just finishing my album before the end of this year and just, you know, getting things popping.
Okay. That was Krayshawn. You may have seen her online hit Gucci Gucci. As we said, she's just been signed to a major deal with Columbia Records, and we'll be hearing her new CD soon, we hope. And she was kind enough to join us from L.A. Krayshawn, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
We're going to go out on your song, Bumpin' Bumpin'. And that's our program for today. I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Let's talk more tomorrow.
From a quadruple Lutz now to the record for the most dogs jumping rope, 13. That's just one of the more than 50,000 feats chronicled in the latest print edition of Guinness World Records released last month. In addition to those skipping dogs, there's also a new record for the longest tongue and the fastest wedding chapel. That would be a wedding chapel on wheels. Well, all this got NPR's Janae West wondering, what isn't a world record?
Actually, there are guidelines. You can't just think of any record and try to break it. Unless you're Homer Simpson.
I'm here to break a world record. What's the longest anyone's ever done this?
Three years.
Oh, fine. I'll just play the banjo with this cobra.
For the rest of us, Guinness World Records does not accept claims for perfect attendance, silent reading, elbow licking?
In reality, a lot of people can do it.
That's Mike Janella, head of the U.S. Records Management Team at Guinness. He says in general, the key to a potential new world record is that it must be
measurable, breakable, verifiable, and also interesting.
According to the guidelines, then, the organization won't accept massage marathon records because Guinness, quote, cannot visually judge style and form as to be correctly done for a long time. In other words,
after 2 or 3 hours, what does a massage become, really, except maybe just keeping your hands on someone's back?
Here's another no-go from Guinness.
Magic mirror on the wall, who is the fairest one of all?
Beauty, though that doesn't stop people from claiming to be the fairest. Truth be told, some of the alleged records rejected by Guinness are every bit as interesting as the ones they take. There was the man who claims to use mind control over sporting events. and another who swears he set the record for romantic brush-offs.
And every time he keeps asking her to try and actually set a date and a time and a place to go, she says she's busy and that she can't make it. And he applied to us saying it's been going on for more than a year, and he was wondering if that was a record for the longest time between asking someone out on a date and actually going on it.
On the flip side of all this is a guy like Ashrita Furman. He has the world record for, well, breaking the most world records. He currently holds more than 100 titles. One of his favorites
is racing for the fastest mile in a sack. And I did that in about 16 minutes and change. But I raced in Mongolia against a yak. Of course, I was in the sack, not the yak.
But Furman says even some of his submissions to Guinness have been denied, including one
for most salt shakers balanced on edge. So I submitted it, and they sent me back a notice saying, no, that's not something we're interested in.
So whatever the record, whether it's the most, the fastest, the highest, and whether or not it's accepted, there is one common thread. Again, here's Guinness World Records adjudicator Mike Janella.
The number one thing that connects everyone together is that you want to say, I can do this better than anybody else on this planet.
Perhaps the hardest part? Figuring out exactly what that is. Janae West, NPR News.
Anything you can do, I can do better. I can do anything better than you.
No, you can't.
Yes, I can.
No, you can't.
Yes, I can.
No, you can't.
Yes, I can. Yes, I can.
Anything you can be, I can be greater. Sooner or later, I'm greater than you.
No, you're not.
Yes, I am.
No, you're not.
Yes, I am.
No, you're not.
Yes, I am. Yes, I am. I can shoot a partridge with a single cartridge.
I can get a sparrow with a bow and arrow.
I can live on bread and cheese.
And only on that?
Yes.
So can a rat.
Our music segment today, the new Sinatra. Well, Justin Timberlake may very well be his generation's Sinatra or Gene Kelly or Fred Astaire.
Don't be so quick to...
He sings, he dances, he acts, and in recent years, Justin Timberlake's made a name for himself in comedy bits on Saturday Night Live. In last year's film, The Social Network, he played Sean Parker, an early backer of Facebook, and Timberlake's portrayal earned him high praise from the critics. His new movie is a futuristic sci-fi thriller. It's called In Time. Timberlake plays Will Salas. He's a man who is trapped in a world where no one ages past 25 years old, and money can literally save your life. When he sat down with us recently, we asked him about his music, his life, and, of course, his new film.
It's a future where time is the currency. You know, time is money, and we're able to give that money back and forth.
A man named Henry Hamilton gave me over a century. He said he didn't need it anymore. It was a gift. I'm not a thief. But hey, if you guys are looking for stolen time, maybe you should arrest everyone here.
And, you know, our lifespan is directly linked to a digital ticking clock that's on our left forearm. And when you run out of time, you die. It's about separating class by wealth.
Justin Timberlake, this is really the first time that you have played the leading character in the film. What was that like for you? Was it difficult for you?
It's funny, when you're making the movie, you're obviously not as conscious of it, and then you screen the whole thing after they finish it, and you become incredibly insecure because you're seeing your face the whole film. But I don't know. I think I wanted to play this character because I admired him. I admired his courage and his brass. So it was a lot of fun to play this character. I mean, look, you tack on getting to shoot guns and kick ass and kiss hot girls and flip cars, and it's like every boyhood fantasy.
Isn't that your real life, though?
Yeah. I shoot guns at people. I try to get in a fight once a day and just randomly kiss as many women as possible. No, you know, I think it's every boyhood fantasy trapped into one film. So, I mean, I had a ball playing this character.
Justin, the breakthrough role for you was the one you played in the film Social Network as Sean Parker. How much did that film open a whole new world for you?
Yeah, that's sort of my running joke with all of my closest friends, is that I should have a business card that says, David Fincher put me in a movie. No, I obviously saw that character on the page as sort of this kind of sociopath in a way. And I felt like the biggest trick that I could possibly pull off in playing that character was sort of, for as long as possible, make the audience question who they should side with. And I feel like my favorite villains, in a way, tend to do that. And I didn't necessarily see him as a villain. I thought he had a very clear-cut point of view. And, you know, when you walk away from that film, it's you still have to say, you know, without the character of Sean Parker in that movie, that company never reaches $1 billion. I'm bringing sexy back.
Justin, I'm looking at a photograph that was taken of you for Vanity Fair. It ran over the summer, and you're in a hotel room. There's a beautiful woman behind you. Your tie is undone, and you're holding what looks like a glass of scotch, very sort of suave. And it just occurred to me that women like you, men like you, it seems like you don't have a problem being likable. And I'm wondering how much you think that has to do with the comedy that you've done.
I don't know. I feel like there's something to be said about feeling comfortable with what you have and don't have. And for instance, I don't think I'm particularly a great singer, but I feel like I write songs that complement my voice, you know, and I feel like it's unique. And I don't feel like I'm particularly a great actor, for instance, but I feel like I approach each thing that I do with some level of sensitivity. And I would say that comedy in general is the most disarming.
What about you, Cornelius Timberlake? What do you hope your great-great-grandson will be like?
I actually dream of a day when my great-great-grandson will bring sexy back.
bring sexy back? What does that mean?
It'll be gone and he'll bring it back.
Laughter can be, it kind of breaks this wall down that I feel like people have because they might have some perception of who you might be. I guess I would definitely agree with you on that.
There's a price to pay for it. I mean, you can't walk around Los Angeles or New York or you can't really have a normal day, can you?
I don't know. I mean, I feel like, you know, listen, I feel like I have normal days just like everybody else where I do walk around New York. And let's be clear, no one walks around Los Angeles. We all drive. It's ridiculous. But, you know, for every sort of experience I have where you feel like you might be photographed in your free time or someone might recognize you, I can add them up to days as well that you don't have that experience. And I don't know, maybe it's just that those aren't as interesting to talk about. Take my order, cause your body like a burial. Let me walk into your body till you hear me out. Turn me on, my baby, don't you cut me out. Turn me on, my baby, don't you cut me out. Take my order, cause your body like a burial.
Justin, I know that you've been focusing on your acting career, and you haven't had an album since 2006. But there is, as you may know, an online campaign. It's called Justin Timberlake Make Music Again. One of the YouTube clips has like 400,000 views. Do you know about this?
I actually took to my Twitter to post it.
So what do you think about that?
I thought it was very funny.
Yeah. But I mean, people do want this. And of course, you know, you make your own choices. But does it ever factor into how you think about things? I mean, do you ever think, well, maybe I should start thinking about that again?
Yeah, I mean, I think for me, specifically when it comes to music, I don't think that I need any persuading to think about it. It's always kind of in the back of your mind, but I think it's part of who I am and always will be, I mean, in a very cellular way. When you grow up doing, you know, one thing, I think you get to this place where you want to try new things and, you know, I do think that we live in the type of world where people get comfortable with you in one way, and so seeing you in a different way it takes some time.
Hmm. Yeah. Justin, last year you did something for NPR that was more meaningful and valuable than 100 hours of me doing my show, which is you wore an NPR T-shirt, and it was photographed and published in a magazine. So I want to thank you for that.
Well, I told you, it wasn't because I thought it was hip. I actually am a really big fan.
Well, by all means, wear that shirt as much as you want.
Okay. I'll have to get a new one, you know. It's gotten some wear and tear. I actually wear it a lot, so.
All right, good. Just make sure you're photographed on those days.
I'm not sure how to do that, but you have my word. If I happen to see someone photographing me, I won't cover up the logo.
All right. That's actor and musician Justin Timberlake. His new movie, In Time, is in theaters now. Justin, thank you so much.
No, my pleasure. Thank you.
Don't feel me, baby. It's just Justin. Listen, I kinda noticed something one night in your colorful face. It's kinda weird to me since you're so fine. If it's up to me, your face.
And for Saturday, that's Weekends and All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Guy Raz. Check out our weekly podcast, The Best of Weekends and All Things Considered. You can find it at iTunes or at npr.org/weekendatc. And for audio outtakes from interviews on this program and previews of what's coming up, you can follow me on Twitter. That's at NPR Guy Raz, spelled GUYRAZ. We're back with a whole new hour of radio tomorrow. Until then, thanks for listening and have a great night.